ground.
Oh, no you don't,
said Ryan as his rogue emerged from the dust at half health.
Now it's my turn. Mark, set a goddamn flank for me right now.
The dwarf rushed at the bull with his battered tower shield lifted high, striking at the creature with it while releasing a taunt shout at the same time. Rylan Silverblade unleashed his combo. That was the thing with rogue characters. They were hardly useful against hordes, but against a single opponent, they really shone. And if there was something that Ryan loved, it was being in the spotlight. First, he unleashed a shadow strike straight from the front, both blades glowing purple as the rogue flashed and disappeared before the bull had a chance to make a move, only to reappear a second later behind the boss. A smoking crisscross slash appeared on the bull's flank. The boss tried to face the rogue, but the taunt from Mark beat its spirit and forced it to try to stomp the fighter down while Rylan unleashed a sneak attack flurry from the back, purple light erupting from each strike. The rogue then activated a shadow step followed by an eviscerate. Rylan disappeared in a puff of smoke and reappeared right atop the bull's neck as his curved daggers glowed red. The bull tried to dodge out of the way, but its bulk made it too slow. The rogue fell upon its flank as his weapons swung down at the same time with magically enhanced strength. There was a sound of flesh tearing and bone cracking, and the creature's head rolled on the floor, the light of its eyes slowly fading away. Rylan Silverblade did a cartwheel and landed just before the bull's corpse had time to fall.
Damn,
Omar said.
You almost soloed the thing.
There. That's how you do it,
Ryan said. Then, under his breath,
bunch of fucking noobs, really. I don't know why I waste my time with you.
With the boss dead, destroying the seat was a trivial matter. Lisa did the honors with her mace. The dungeon slowly collapsed around them, the experience points slowly trickling in through a status bar on a corner of the screen as they ran out. The way Ivalice Online worked, they'd get the gold coins they'd earned from the wreckage a few hours after the fact, sent straight to their inventory by the church. That was how playing Ivalice Online worked. It was a very strange game, and Lisa couldn't help but wonder about it. For decade-old software, sometimes it could be quite realistic. Other times, it made no sense whatsoever. Outside, back in the real world, it had gotten late. Diana would likely be home soon, drunk out of her mind, and hopefully alone. But in the meantime, the room was freezing and dark, as if the candlelight wasn't enough to fight off the strange, sudden fear that threatened to overwhelm Lisa. With one trembling hand, she flicked on the light switch. Back in the war room of the haunt, Ed and Levy studied the wreckage from the dungeon's final room using a crystal ball.
"Sorry about your dungeon, Lord Wright,"
said the ball's owner, a floating blue pufferfish with spikes protruding from its tough hide. Diviner Folk was an Abnatir, a kind of demonic inhabitant from the Netherworld. Folk was young and timid and had spent most of his life studying. Ed was the first dungeon lord the Abnatir worked for, and Folk was visibly excited. Ed couldn't help but think of him as the intern.
"It's quite all right," Ed said. "It did what it was supposed to do. Still, please send a message to Kleck and Kaga to get more acid oozes whenever they've got some free time."
"Are the oozes part of your master plan?"
Folk asked, his giant black eyes bulging with amazement.
"Not really. I just really like them."
Ed shrugged and then tapped the crystal ball as if dealing with an old TV and trying to improve the reception.
"Did you find the beam?"
"It was as you said, Lord Wright," said the intern.
"Using Master Lavina's crystal and my personal detection spell, I was able to pinpoint a beam spell connected to each hero. The spell is too advanced for me to figure out much about it, but it seems to be some kind of complex mixture of effects.
Instructions and conditions, along with status updates and confirmations. Whatever it is, it involves many schools of spellcraft."
He said this with unmistakable admiration in his voice.
"I'd give anything to talk with the person who designed it."
"Likewise," Ed thought.
"How did you know?"
Levy asked Ed.
"About the beam?"
"I didn't. Not exactly, at least," Ed explained. "But there had to be some way the players control the heroes from Earth, as well as a very good reason why the Inquisition is using gamers instead of trained Inquisitors to man them.
You taught me that all spells need to connect with their target, so I figured there was some kind of magic involved and took the gamble.
But golems do not need an external set of instructions,
Falk said.
That's what the heroes are, right? Some kind of advanced construct?
Yes and no. They are a kind of golem with no autonomy, controlled by a third party through that signal. When the anti-magic field interrupted my old wizard's control signal, and it suffered enough internal damage, an internal enchantment activated a self-destruct sequence. It wasn't terribly complicated to set up. A couple fireball runes, then a simple status mechanism hooked up to an alarm to trigger the runes. The head researcher rubbed her sleep-deprived eyes.
The control signal also triggers the teleport, then? No wonder it's heroic ranked. Only a few Heligian wizards are powerful enough to set up that kind of mechanism.
She bit her lip and picked at her fingernails.
It's a double set of security measures. That's why all dungeon lords had so much trouble with it. If they interrupt the signal, the internal self-destruct triggers. If they disable the self-destruct, the signal teleports the hero away.
Exactly, Ed said. So far, we know for certain three things about the heroes that the Dark does not. The signal, the self-destruct, and the power source.
The power source, Lord Wright?
Asked the intern.
It's the thing the hero construct uses to increase its own ley lines,
Levy explained.
From the looks of it, they do it by directly stealing the dungeon's energy output when they destroy the seat. That's not a thing a normal golem is able to do. I'd say that if we were to open up a hero, we'd find some kind of device related to a dungeon lord.
Falk deflated a bit.
An artifact in each hero? But there are hundreds of heroes. Not even Haligis has that kind of fortune.
The intern shuddered.
If they did, we'd be doomed.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, then, Ed said. We can learn more about the power supply by catching us a hero and opening it up. Levy regarded him with a concerned glint in her eye.
And can you... us, I mean. Can we do it? We just saw what happened when we tried to handle the double safety measures.
Ed massaged the stiffness in the back of his neck. We can. Maybe. But the only way I can think of will be terribly dangerous.
Of course it will,
Levy said. She placed a hand on Ed's shoulder, a surprisingly tender gesture coming from her.
But we're going to do it anyway, aren't we?
Oh, yes. Ed grinned at her. The good news is, if we get away with it, I think we just found a way to counter the heroes. It won't be a perfect solution, but it's going to shift the odds in our favor. Falk ballooned in surprise.
Is that true, Lord Wraith? Have you finally ended the hero's advantage against the Dark?
Ed shook his head and did his best to fight off an alder-like urge to be mysterious until the very end. He lost. Not exactly, Diviner Falk. It'd be more accurate to say that Levy was the one who did it. Now it was Levy's turn to stare at him with wide-open eyes.
What are you talking about? Me?
All this time, it's been right in front of us, Ed explained. The dish you created? The towers we're building? That's our starting point. We don't need advanced scramblers. We need to build the haunt a couple signal-jamming towers. He paused for effect, then went on to say, And then we build them all across Staravos. Chapter 22 Hunting Monsters. The crowd in the waterside market flowed through the streets like an angry river about to flood. Yet somehow, it never did. Fights started and ended, cut purses made off with their loot or were mauled by angry sailors, and homeless men with glazed, pixie dust eyes stared straight ahead while begging for coin. No one stopped to enjoy the scenery. There was not much to enjoy anyway, and a bit of sightseeing would mark you as a tourist, and thus a target, to the street rats that littered the alleys and shadowy corners. The air was hot and damp and stank of rotten fish and horse dung. The streets were paved with mud, drug stands and brothels sprouting to the sides like weeds. In such a place as Constantina's waterside market, few paid much attention to a pair of Kuftar running errands. Kuftar were common enough in Undercity, but that wasn't saying much. Despite non-humans being rare in Staravos, Undercity saw more intelligent species in a day than other Starovosi cities did in a lifetime. Minotaurs, slime people, satyrs, and centaurs, even the occasional triton defying the mighty tide to trade ashore. Few had seen a griffin up close, though. Griffins were Heligian. In a way, Gallio knew he should have been shocked by the rampant degeneracy going on around him. From his vantage point near the corner of the street, he saw a group of ruffians, none older than 12, pushing an elderly witch doctor to the ground and stealing his purse as he screamed bloody murder their way. The kids ran off as fast as they could while the man sprang to his feet and cast a shoddy, black market version of Arcane Familiar, which sent a pair of fanged red flying fish soaring through the air until they struck the back of one kid and sent him careening face first into the mud, smoke pouring from the charred skin of his back. Next to Gallio, Alvedra tensed. He put a calming hand on her shoulder.
"Easy there. Let the watch handle it."
He nodded at the ragtag group of men that sauntered over to the fallen kid. They carried heavy sticks and round iron helmets that looked like inverted soup dishes. Once they reached the kid, who didn't look in any shape to move, they used their sticks to make damn sure.
"They are little more than thugs themselves,"
Alvedra pointed out, doing her best to act nonchalant. Half the watch dragged the unconscious kid away while the other half kept the merchant from charging at the boy, laughing as they did so.
"They are hired thugs," Gallio muttered. "Most of the professional guards were pulled into Mulesius Heights a few days ago. These bullies with sticks are the best the waterfront can afford."
"The militant church is strong enough to protect itself," said Alvedra. "And shouldn't we be the ones stopping them anyway? We know that most criminals hang in these lower districts. Why can't we raid their hideouts and capture them all in one swoop? I'm sure the Light can't abide by us turning a blind eye to what goes on here."
Gallio shook his head while keeping an eye on the pair of Cuffdar that pretended to mull over a fruit stand half a block away.
"The Inquisitor's role is to defeat the Dark. Petty crime is not our job."
He gave a surreptitious nod at Cleric Zeki and Inquisitor Hector, who were watching the Cuffdar from the other end of the street. They returned the nod. All was good on their end as well.
"Besides, you cannot imprison water between your fists. Water does what water does. It flows out. If we were to raid the waterside like you suggest, the criminals would do what they do. They'd scram. Sure, we could catch quite a few of them, but the others would avoid the waterside from that point on. They'd become much harder to keep an eye on, and they'd spread out their bases and operations to honest, hard-working districts."
Alvedra let out a sharp whistle.
"Are you saying we let crime run rampant by the waterside to keep Mulesius Heights from being bothered?"
"I'm saying that anyone who steps into the waterside knows what they're getting into,"
Gallio said without looking at her.
"Now focus, Alvedra."
He pointed with his nose at the distant Cuffdar, who had left the fruit stand while Gallio was speaking.
"They're on the move."
The Inquisitors left their posts and followed. Gallio could feel the sweat soaking his civilian clothes, and moving without the familiar weight of his sword felt wrong, as if he'd walked out the door of his quarters that morning without wearing trousers. Additionally, the shirt's cut was too loose and exposed. It felt like being naked. He much preferred his coarse inquisitorial gambeson, the comfortable weight of his armor pressing over it. He waded through the crowd with a casual stroll. He kept his head down and his brow furrowed as if he had somewhere urgent to go and wasn't in the mood for trouble. It still didn't stop a pair of pickpockets, working in tandem, from trying their luck at his bag. He reached down and caught someone's hand near his belt. He broke it without looking at the man's face, whose whines grew weaker and weaker as Gallio walked away. People left him alone after that. The Cuffdar were far too short for Gallio to make them out among the crowd, but Zeki's shaved head was unmistakable, with an array of white scars drawing maps among the sunburnt skin. Gallio followed Zeki and Hector, matching their pace as to keep the unseen Cuffdar between the two groups. The chase had lasted all morning and most of the afternoon. It had begun outside the city's walls, near the jagged hills of the farmland, so close to the neighboring villages that Gallio's heart had raced for hours in his chest. Thankfully, the two Cuffdar hadn't met with any villager. They'd simply checked their surroundings, and then went into an underground storage camouflaged by carefully placed underbrush. Gallio and the others, following Oak's orders, had crept up to the storage, disabled the alarm spells, and discovered a rough, drone-made cavern with a few leftover sacks of grain. Judging by the smell, the storage had been filled with ale or beer, and it had been recently emptied. Further exploring had revealed a tight tunnel lit by magical torches with railway tracks set over the ground. Alvedra had found signs of recent Kuftar presence, hair and their rotten meat scent, all over the place. After a brief chat, the team had decided the tracks were like a dwarven mining system used to move people and ore across the vast underground distances of the mountains. Zeki had used a mapping spell to determine that the tunnel led straight to Undercity. They could have raced after the Kuftar and captured them right then, but that would have only netted the Inquisition two underlings who probably knew little useful information about the Dungeon Lord and the extent of his infestation among the locals. Still, Oak had been of the mind that Master Enric should send the heroes right then and there to burn the Haga Anashi campsite to the ground. Gallio had dissuaded him. They needed the Haga Anashi for a little longer. If the Inquisition could map Lord Wright's presence, dungeons, and activities, they could extricate him in one strike that minimized innocent loss of life, and even catch him off guard, away from any portal that may allow him to run and fight another day. So they'd come to Undercity well away from the tunnel, and had tracked the two Kuftar by inquiring among the local informers and homeless population, who were always willing to divulge information if you knew how to entice them to talk. Finding the Kuftar again had taken hours, but eventually word came that two Haga Anashi were headed for the waterfront. At some point, the Kuftar had offloaded their booze cargo and ditched their cart, which meant they had had inside help among the city's locals. This spelled bad news for everyone. It lowered the chances that innocent life would be spared in the crossfire. Gallio hoped to Alita's mercy that those yet unknown helpers merely aided the Haga Anashi in smuggling black market booze and did not understand that the Kuftar were working with a dungeon lord. Perhaps that could spare them. But he didn't like their chances. With any luck, the taverns that bought the booze could be spared. But still, it was Oak's call. And if there was even a tiny chance that Wright had doused the booze with anything, the death toll would rise to everyone who had patronized those taverns. No, the thought was too terrible to contemplate. It was in Alita's hands now. The only thing Gallio and the others could do was keep finding out as much as they could. Information would save innocent lives, so he planned to sleep as little as possible over the following days, relying on his Inquisitor's talents to keep him going. They were in a race against time, after all, because the longer they waited, the more likely the risk that Wright would try something nasty. Even though the clan would be spared for a little while longer, there was no saving these two. The Inquisition needed to move fast, and the pair could give them names and locations. Not even the Heligian population knew this side of the Inquisitorial calling. Most of the tracking was done without much magic, and that was the trick. Dungeon lords loved to counter the church's diviners, but most of them forgot to cover their physical tracks. The bards enjoyed harping about battles and fire, about hard justice and necessary sacrifice. But in reality, most of Gallio's career had been spent on the road or on the streets, chasing some lead or some suspect, always gathering information, and only rarely getting into a fight. Sometimes he thought that, with the advent of heroes, the Inquisitors were slowly being relegated to scouting jobs. Find the Dungeon Lord's lair, locate his secondary portals, and then send the heroes to do the dirty work. It wasn't exactly true, though. Dungeon Lords were the Dark's main weapon against the Light, but not the only one. Gallio's work involved chasing away hidden cultists among the common folk, tracking down the source of undead infestations, finding and destroying necromancers' cabals, and so on. A never-ending list. It was as if, for every Dark follower he killed, two more took their place. And it wasn't only the Lothians doing it. No one was free from the danger of Murmur's corruption. A Heligian who had fallen upon hard times was only one desperate pact away from a road to the Mantle or to necromancy, for example. Kuftar, though, had a way of ending up on the wrong side of the law more often than elves or dwarves. It was in their nature to look for trouble, in Gallio's opinion. this particular clan, the Haganashi, was always eager for a fight, more so than their cousins. The militant church had ignored their antics for a while thanks to the useful services they lent to the Staravosi, but Gallio was sure that it was a state of affairs due for a change very soon. The Inquisition now had evidence of the Haganashi aiding a dungeon lord. These two Kufdar would find that out soon enough. They had stopped, so Gallio did the same. Alvedra and he scanned the crowd, searching for whatever it was the Kufdar waited for. A pair of Akathunians hidden by their dark cloaks led a line of a dozen slaves in the middle of the street, with hired mercenaries forcing the crowd to part. One of the slaves, a male Naga, gave Alvedra a pleading look as they passed. His face was so covered in bruises, it was hard to make out his features, but the redhead and the tribal tattoos on his arms told Gallio the Naga had come from Plekth. That Naga was a long way from home. And so was he. Gallio closed his hand into a fist. What part of, if you deal with the Dark's envoys, the Inquisition will burn you alive, was so hard to understand? And yet people did it anyway, and they had the gall to beg for mercy when inevitably caught, and then the Inquisitors would hear their screams when they closed their eyes for years and years, up to the point where their conscience couldn't stand it any longer, and, against all orders, they'd forgive the life of a young orphan captured among the minions of some minor dungeon lord in the middle of nowhere, a kid who had only accepted the pact under threat of torture. How could Alita possibly demand the Inquisitors to take such an innocent life? Hadn't the kid suffered enough? So they would let the kid go in secret, and then it would turn out that the dungeon lord had wanted to increase the strength of his minions so he'd infected them all with werewolf saliva. The Inquisitors would only find this out come full moon, when the kid transformed into a murderous beast that would go through a bloody rampage in the church's hospital, killing and maiming dozens until put down by the very same Inquisitors that had spared him the first time. Those Inquisitors would then be forced to face the extent of their sins, of their failure. They'd look at the broken remains of the people killed by the werewolf, and they'd weep as they brought peace to the few survivors, who were now infected by the beast's saliva. All those innocent lives lost because they hadn't been brave enough to do what the light required them to do. Most of them had taken their own lives afterward. One of the survivors would be sent into exile, his faith broken and his honor lost. He would be shipped off to Staravos, or at least he would do some good. He'd find jobs as a mercenary, and then as a sheriff, among the local population, and he'd slowly rebuild whatever could be salvaged of his faith and his conscience. And then, just as he thought he could find a measure of peace, the sheriff would stumble onto the path of another innocent, this one a young man from another world who had been tricked by the Dark to forge a pact with conditions he couldn't possibly comprehend. It was as if history repeated itself. The stream of innocence to feed the Dark's hunger was never-ending. The sheriff had renewed his vow to the light because he was needed once more, and there was no one else to answer the call. And as sometimes happens with those who lose their faith and then find it again, it came back stronger, and the light of the sun wave, the mark of Alita's chosen, shone on Staravosi land by his hand. He was unworthy. What Alita was saving him for, he didn't know. At the time, he'd thought himself so clever. He'd found a way to save everyone. By sparing the life of the dungeon lord, he'd saved the people he'd lived amongst. What evil could Edward Wright do? He would either resist the temptation of power and remain hidden all his life, or he'd quickly be defeated by the heroes, like Kael Arpidel before him, and hundreds of dungeon lords before both of them. Gallio had never expected Wright to resist. He'd never expected him to fight back. And he'd never expected him to thrive. It was no wonder that the militant church's tenets demanded for the Inquisitor to lay down his conscience and allow Alita to deliver judgment instead, even when the sentence was terrible and inhumane.
Inhumane, Gallio thought. It makes sense.
How could a mere mortal like him hope to stand against evil when mercy itself was Murmur's tool? Only the Light's cold justice could hope to stand against such an abominable being. And now Gallio could only but wonder, as he and Alvedra neared the dark alley where the Kuftar had disappeared into, if he'd once again been tricked by the dark. If, by saving a few lives, he'd condemned thousands more. According to Alvedra, the Kuftar were excellent trackers in their own right, but all their training focused on monsters and beasts. They had little experience with the trappings of men, and even less experience maneuvering through a city such as Undercity. To their noses, the smell of 50,000 inhabitants of Undercity must have been as overwhelming as the constant flash of thunder in a pitch-black night. And she was right. The two Kuftar only saw the Inquisitor's approach when it was already too late. They froze for an entire second, their ears rigid like a surprised dog's, their mouths open and their tongues partially hanging out. The two hooded humans they were meeting with, however, reacted instantly. Right as Gallio was saying,
"Stop! In the name of—"
They were already drawing their daggers and readying themselves to lunge. Alvedra aimed an ice bolt rune while screaming at them to drop their weapons, but before she could fire, one of the humans grabbed something from one of the many pockets of his belt and snapped his fingers. There was a spark as he threw a small pellet to the floor, and then a cloud of thick smoke engulfed the alley.
"Don't kill them!"
Gallio reminded Alvedra, while drawing his own dagger and entering a defensive stance. He tried to peer through the smoke, but it was no use. His eyes watered, and he had to blink furiously to clear his vision. Somewhere in front of him, Cleric Zeki screamed,
"Stormwind!"
And a violent air current slapped Gallio's cheeks while trying to throw him to the ground. Only his swordsman's balance steadied him, and the fact that Zeki knew he and Alvedra were in the spell's line of fire. He caught Alvedra's flailing arm, then pushed forward as the smoke dissipated in seconds, flushed out of the alley as fast as a sailor's wages in a whorehouse. 2 seconds had passed since the Inquisitors entered the alley from both sides. The Kuftar were still too stunned to react. They'd drawn their scimitars, of course, but that would help them precious little. The cloaked humans, though, were gone.
How?
Gallio stole a glance upward at the rooftops of the dilapidated buildings walling the alley. They'd made no sound as they climbed, and their speed implied they carried special gear with them, maybe even enchanted.
"Thieves' Guild,"
he said, putting two and two together.
"Oh, dunghill."
"Wright's infestation runs deeper than we thought,"
Alvedra said, half growling. The Kuftar stood back to back, each one facing one end of the alleyway.
"That's a bad idea," Gallio warned them. "Haven't you realized what you're up against? Look at my character sheet."
"I don't see how we have many options left. We may as well give it a shot,"
one of the Haga Anashi said, his voice surprisingly calm, given the circumstances. Gallio had to give it to them. The monster hunters had poise. The wind buffeted the alley, making the Kuftar's pelt sway in all directions. Zeki and Hector closed in from their end, and Alvedra did the same. Gallio remained where he stood. There would be no fight. The Inquisition couldn't afford to fight fairly when dealing with dungeon lords. The wind became angry, and a sort of pressure pushed against Gallio's ears. The Kuftar noticed it then, the shadow masking the moon, rapidly growing. An eagle shrieked, very close and growing even closer. Someone screamed in surprise as a winged beast with the body of a lion landed gracefully atop the rooftop of the nearest building with such violence that it sent slivers of clay flying in all directions like shrapnel. Its beak was curved, designed to dig deep and tear the meat out of its prey, and its golden eyes, surrounded by white feathers, were focused on the Kuftar below. A man in full inquisitorial garb was riding the lion's back.
"So,"
said Inquisitor Oak, glowing sword in one hand and the reins in the other,
"do you still feel like giving it a shot?"
Chapter 23. Dungeon Upgrades. Setting up the fake dungeon had strained the Haunt's coffers even with Corgoron's line of credit. It had earned Ed no tangible benefit, no loot or new talent choices, but it had provided him a marginal amount of experience points, which was a welcome surprise. Apparently, defending and losing a dungeon was enough, according to objectivity, to increase the dungeon owner's experience. Ed stepped away from the table in the war room, which was strewn with Levy's new spellbooks, and faced his friends.
I guess it's finally time to buy dungeon vision. It's simply going to be too useful at defending the haunt for me to pass up.
Levy and Cass exchanged weary glances.
So, it looks like there's no dissuading you. Would you mind waiting until I come back before buying it, though?
Levy asked. With a sigh, she stepped up and headed out the door.
Wait, where are you going?
Alder asked.
To take one last bath before wondering if someone's looking over my shoulder,
the witch replied, then left. Cass trimmed her fingernails with a dagger while Alder chuckled to himself.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, Ed muttered, rolling his eyes.
Actually,
Cass said, dropping the dagger on the table and standing up.
I'll be right back as well.
She left without saying anything else.
Women, am I right?
Alder asked, munching on a piece of cheese. He smiled innocently at Ed.
Always so distrustful.
It's all right, Alder. You can go, Ed told the bard.
Oh, thank Mama,
Alder said as he jumped up and hurried out the door.
Sorry, Ed.
Ed shook his head and sighed. Then he realized he wasn't alone in the room.
How about you, Kleck? He asked the spider rider.
Kleck looked at him with big, round, confused eyes.
I don't understand what the big deal is, he said. Baths! The water is cold and makes my fur feel weird. Soap stings my eyes. Why would you want to peep on baths?
The dungeon lord eased himself back into his chair and considered this.
No idea, buddy. People are weird is all.
Kleck reached for a small bowl filled with insects and fruit and plopped on a chair next to Ed.
They are.
They really are,
the Batblin said, deep in thought. About 2 hours later, the dungeon lord and the spider rider reunited with their freshened-up friends.
All right, let's get it over with,
Levy said, sighing in defeat. Ed shot her a small smile and activated his evil eye. A few seconds later, he bought the dungeon vision talent using his stored points along with the ones he'd gotten from losing the test dungeon. Instantly, he felt the tiny change in his body, like a small twinkle rolling alongside his veins. It was as if he could feel his magical ley lines increasing in complexity. Along with the talent came the instinctual knowledge of how to activate it, which he did while standing up. This proved to be a mistake. As soon as he activated the dungeon vision, a flurry of overwhelming sensations reached him through his evil eye. It was as if his eyeballs had suddenly flown out toward the ceiling in a second while still remaining attached to his skull. Suddenly, he could see the war room from a top-down perspective, all the papers over the table, his friends' confused stances, their heads aimed his way, and his own body clutching the table as if he was a sailor holding onto a ship's railing for dear life in the middle of a storm. He was still aware of his own body and could move normally. It was only his vision that had shifted. As a reflex, he tried to stand and gather his bearings. Instead of the view adjusting with his movement, it remained in the same position. Vertigo rushed in, and he fell to the floor face first, scrambling confusedly like a blind man while at the same time watching himself do it.
So, that went well,
Kes said, helping him up. Ed rubbed a sore spot on his knee as he deactivated the vision and everything returned to normal.
I wasn't ready, he said. It's one hell of an experience.
So that's why Lord Kale always sat down in his seat before using it for a while,
Levy said.
I've always wondered about that. Changing how your own senses work isn't so easy after all, right?
There was a hint of hope there, as if she were hoping dungeon vision wouldn't become part of Ed's repertoire of frequent talents after all. Ed shrugged and gave her a guilty grin.
Actually, it was quite a familiar sensation. It's hard to explain, but it's not the first time I've seen this talent. On the contrary, it's like meeting an old friend.
He activated the talent again, but this time he was ready for it. He watched himself from his vantage point. Carefully, he stood up, easing his body into the different situation.
How could you already be familiar with it?
Alder asked.
You said that Earth lacks any magic.
Through a computer screen, Ed explained. Dungeon vision feels almost exactly like an isometric camera view. That means from the top down at a slight angle. Hell, I wonder if I can move it around. Ah, there. It wasn't hard to visualize the controls shifting the imaginary camera around, and that was exactly how Ed thought of the talent. Like a video game's camera. Once he was able to finish the comparison, he quickly became used to it, and it stuck in his mind. The camera brought him away from the room, bypassing wall and ceiling as if they weren't there. Outside, by the kitchens, the janitor Batblins fought a small war against a baby acid ooze that had escaped from Kaga's breeding facilities underground. So far, the janitors had managed to keep the acid of the ooze in check by covering it in flour, much to the cook's chagrin. Then the janitors chased the monster around, trying to catch it with a cast-iron pot. The problem was, the smaller the ooze, the faster it could move, and although most oozes were barely smart enough to feed themselves, this one had instinct enough to move away from the screeching Batblins that kept throwing handfuls of flour its way. As the janitors ran after it, they passed by a halfling wearing a tattered tunic, an individual that Ed had never seen around before. He was clutching his head and looking around, looking as if he had no idea where the hell he was. He seemed extremely hungover.
"Everything is business as usual in the kitchens," Ed announced, back in the war room.
He went down several levels. Yarlin's coffin was in the middle of her crypt, closed, with the vampire sleeping inside until the day cleared. On a whim, Ed tried to look inside, but the camera couldn't get past the wooden lid. That meant there was a limit to the camera's knowledge.
"It's probably for the best," he thought.
"What are you looking at now?"
Levy asked him.
"I'm just looking around your room," Ed lied. "It really needs some tidying up, you know."
Someone smacked him hard on the shoulder. Ed chuckled and ended the talent.
"Defending the haunt will be much easier if I learn to master this ability. Not bad for a couple dozen experience points."
"It isn't supposed to be a powerful upgrade,"
Levy said, pouting and crossing her arms.
"I don't think you should overuse it. Kale, no, any dungeon lord I know of, just sat on their seats, brooded a bit, and made sure their minions weren't messing anything up in their dungeon. Unless the place was under attack, of course."
"So that's how most bosses in Ivalice Online always knew where we were at all times." "Well, sorry to disappoint you, but I'll exploit any advantage I can get over the other dungeon lords. Murmur knows I'll need it."
Especially if, a year from now, he was to face them in Tillman's Endeavor, a prospect he was still mulling over. In the meantime, it was best to start practicing.
"Kes," he asked, "would you mind designing a special training regimen for me? I'll try to spar while using the top-down view."
Kes raised an eyebrow.
"Are you sure, Ed? A minute ago, you couldn't stand while using it."
"I'm pretty sure, yes. Do your worst."
A mischievous smile drew across the marshal's lips.
"Ah, my favorite words. Well, if you're sure, come with me, Lord Wraith. Let's test out your new toy."
Ed's good spirits faltered a bit. Kes had looked very enthusiastic as she left the room.
"I mean, I did ask her," he thought.
But the way she whistled to herself gave him goosebumps.
"Now you've done it," Alder whispered. "Let's go, Levy. We can't miss this. I'll need to witness it so I can accurately reproduce it in the Haunt Chronicles."
"That's one hell of a good idea, my dear bard,"
Levy said. Ed's lips twitched a bit.
"Fantastic."
Not only did his friends get to see him make an ass of himself, future generations probably would, too. A day later, the dungeon lord walked down the corridors and passageways of the haunt, the cold underground air mixing with the warmth coming from walls and floor alike and becoming a pleasant breeze against his cheeks. He pulled up the neck of his tunic and patted his wild black hair away from his eyes as he swayed his way like a drunk man through a spinning corridor. Kes's training had been rough. Although he had nearly a lifetime of gaming experience with the top-down view, it was another thing entirely to have his own body, and all his other senses, react to his input directly instead of a character through a keyboard or controller like he was used to. But he was making progress, and to speed things up, he was using the dungeon vision to keep watch on himself at all times.
He'd only stumbled against the walls twice in the last hour. Almost without making a conscious effort to do so, he moved the camera away from himself and down the rest of the corridor until he could see his destination. Hyorche had finished his work at the forge and was in the middle of guiding his Batplin assistants to clean their workplace and ready things up for tomorrow. Near a corner, his younger daughter played with a small, hairy puppy that yipped silently at her. Ed changed his viewpoint to hover right above himself and reached the forge after a few steps.
"Lord Wright, I was wondering when you'd stop by and visit,"
called Hyorche as soon as the blacksmith saw him. The Batplins stopped working and glanced at them, doing their best to pretend not to eavesdrop.
"Shame what happened with your new dungeon. I heard all about it. A fine attempt, though." "It did what it was supposed to do," Ed said.
He ended his dungeon vision effect, since it was getting awkward, but the dizzying change of point of view almost made him trip on his own feet. He recovered at the last second and pretended as if nothing had happened.
But thanks for the sympathy. In fact, that's why I'm here.
Hyorche looked slightly disappointed.
So, not because of the minecarts. Too bad. I wanted to show you our new brake system. Later, my friend. Work comes before fun. I guess it does. How can my forge best serve you, Ed?
Hyorche asked, drawing near.
Can I interest you, perhaps, in a new set of eyeglasses? Word is, people have seen you stumble around like a blind Batplin all over the training center. Real funny, Hyorche.
The two walked together, away from the prying ears of the Batplins, while the broad-shouldered forge master laughed under his breath.
So?
He asked as they reached a secluded corner of the forge. Ed handed him his sword.
Have you ever gone to the Netherworld?
The man cocked his head.
Are you telling me to go to hell, Ed?
Well, yes, but it's for work, Ed explained.
Think of it as a business trip. I need you to enchant my gear, sword and armor, to start. Also, I need you to look into finding a cheap way to mass-produce enchantments for our armory. The second part is easier said than done,
Hyorche said.
If you make it into a quest, I'll see what I can do, but it's going to take time. Your gear, on the other hand, that I can do quickly enough. What type of effect are you wanting for your sword?
He hefted Ed's blade around, testing its balance and weight.
Perhaps a vorpal enchantment, so your enemies lose their heads when they fight you? The problem is, that kind of magic is out of our budget. We could do ice, thunder, fire. You know, the basics. Or do you want something a bit fancier?
Ed shook his head.
Actually, I need a specific kind of enchantment. Make that sword into an anti-magic weapon.
The smith looked bewildered.
Anti-magic? Are you sure, Ed? Swords are not the usual choice for an anti-magic field. I don't think there's enough space for the runes and the magical circle, and in any case, it'd be even more expensive than the Vorpal enchantment.
Hyorche tapped the sword's blade, as if to highlight his argument.
Besides, you're a magic user as well. An anti-magic field would do more damage than good to you.
That's not what I had in mind, Ed said. I don't need the sword to project a field. I only need it to disable the enchantment of anything it pierces or cuts, if that makes any sense.
It should be easier to make than an entire anti-magic field, right?
Hyorche scratched his beard.
Yes, in theory. It's still a strange petition, but you seem to have something in mind for it. In any case, as the forge master, it's my duty to make sure you realize that running someone through with your sword usually makes disabling their enchantments redundant, right?
Ed smiled.
Most of the time. But yes, I do have something in mind.
Something insanely dangerous that might end up with him eating a couple fireballs at point-blank range. Or worse. But it was better than not having a plan at all.
Then I'll do as you say, Ed. I trust your judgment. How about your armor? Some strange request for it as well? Perhaps I can enchant it to break down at the first sign of danger, to keep your enemies confused?
Thanks, but let's keep it simple. Add the best magical armor we can afford to it.
Maybe something that can tank a fireball at close range, if we combo it with my pledge of armor.
So, you do have expensive taste after all. It won't come cheap, but I agree with your choice. The Haunt needs you alive if we're going to keep hanging out with horned spiders and vampires.
The blacksmith waved for a couple batblins to come closer.
I'll have my apprentices go fetch your armor, and I'll head into the netherworld as soon as possible.
Ed thanked the man and sent a message to Kess to prepare a squadron to keep Yorche safe. Then he activated his evil eye and created an upgrade quest so Yorche could get experience points for designing a way to mass enchant the Haunt's gear. That done, the Dungeon Lord returned to his top-down view of the dungeon, found his next stop, and headed out of the forge while the Batblins ran in all directions, scrambling to prepare for their trip. The seamstresses had their own workshop inside the Haunt, a couple chambers with materials, looms, and assorted tools for them to practice their trade. It was the first time Ed had stepped inside the workshop since creating it. Tapestries in progress hung from wooden hooks, with rows of bundles of cloth strewn in a chaotic mixture of color and material by the walls. The spin of the wheels mixed with the cacophony of gossip and singing as batblins and drones entered in and out, carrying cloth or finished dresses and other garments. Ed strolled past the dresses and tunics on display and reached the middle of a circle of women from all ages who were working and chatting among themselves. He stood there awkwardly for a few seconds until one of them raised her eyes and saw him. She yelped and jumped to her feet, probably ruining the sleeve she had been working on.
"Dungeon Lord!"
she exclaimed. The surrounding chatter died, making Ed quite literally the center of attention.
"What a pleasant, albeit unexpected, surprise!"
the seamstress went on.
"The only member of your court that visits us with any frequency is Chronicler Alder.
What can we do to help you, your maliciousness?"
another seamstress asked.
"Are you interested in a new tunic, perhaps?"
She strolled around Ed in a playful, flirty way.
"Black, perhaps, so it matches your eyes. We can get you some silver thread. That should do justice to someone of your station, my lord."
"Or perhaps are you interested in us, Dungeon Lord?"
a third woman asked, batting her eyelashes. The others laughed and cheered her on. Ed had spent enough time around the Sterevosi to know there was no winning this war while he was so outnumbered, so he gave her his best innocent smile and decided to play dumb, while trying to remember her name.
"Thank you, Viorica. Perhaps another time. Right now, I need all of you to help me with an experiment."
He gave them the small package he was carrying with him.
"Ah, a gift,"
Viorica said. She hurried to open it while the others huddled around her to take a better look. Inside, the package appeared to be a rough, very coarse sort of cotton-like fabric, gray and dirty-looking.
"What is this?"
asked one of them, passing the fabric around her fingers.
"It's so ugly. Did you shear a batblin, my lord?"
"Rodica, don't be rude,"
Viorica exclaimed. Then she touched the fabric, looking both confused and disappointed at the same time.
"But I do admit I have no idea what you wish for us to do with this, my lord."
"It's thread made from spider web," Ed explained.
At once, Viorica removed her hand as if she had been touching acid without realizing it.
"Back on my native world, people discovered that you could use spider silk to craft a very lightweight armor that is also useful against impacts. The problem was, since Earth's spiders are much smaller than horned spiders, creating a single vest is very expensive. So I figured the Haunt needs a way to keep our minions safe, and we seem to have more than enough spider web to make into silk. So why not try it?"
Hopefully a spider silk vest would be tough enough to withstand an arrow, yet lighter and less conspicuous than gambeson or plate. The seamstresses considered this, more than a few of them, with a disbelieving, almost disgusted look to their faces.
"I'd rather not touch something that came from a horned spider's behind,"
Rodica said, frowning.
"It's so unsanitary."
A few others nodded their approval.
"Come on, ladies,"
Viorica chided them.
"Our Dungeon Lord came to us asking for a personal favor. It's our responsibility to the Haunt to do our best, no matter what the favor is,"
she said, with another suggestive glance Ed's way.
"How else are our brave warriors supposed to head into combat against the dreaded light without knowing we're here? safely waiting for their triumphant return and doing our best to protect them.
You've spent way too much time with that bard, Viorica,
the third seamstress told her, but she regarded the spider silk fabric with less obvious animosity.
Look, just keep those spiders away from me and I'll try to help.
That's the spirit, Narcissa,
Viorica told her friend.
How did you make this first batch?
Rodica asked Ed.
Well, I transmuted it into thread using spiderweb. I figured that there's some kind of procedure for making it into useful fabric, but I've got no idea what that may be. This was my second best option.
Rodica shook her head and lifted a strand of gray thread.
A fine idea, my lord, but I'm afraid it won't work. This thread lacks the quality we need to make it into a vest meant for combat. It'd fall apart. See?
She pulled the thread with little force, and it immediately broke.
We'll have to conduct many tests,
Narcissa said, but smiled at her own words.
Just like Master Lavina. It sounds fun, actually. Perhaps you could make it into a quest, my lord. Reasonable people like us don't run around hitting monsters with heavy sticks, so experience points are scarce.
Ed nodded, happy that the seamstresses were now on his side. It'd take time, but hopefully the next time an ogre clubbed him, he wouldn't even get a bruise. And if the vests saved even one life, the effort would be well worth it. Ed sat alone in his dimly lit quarters, enjoying a quick dinner while his drone butler hung by a corner and glared at him.
Come sit if you want, Ed offered the drone.
It was a chat they'd had many times. The drone's response was always the same, a half-assed curtsy followed by an obscene gesture when he thought Ed wasn't looking.
Suit yourself, Ed said, chuckling.
He wondered how close the drones were to imps in nature, and where the hell they came from. He suspected it was one of those things where the truth was best kept under wraps. He was eating with the door to his back. When it opened, he didn't bother to turn around.
Kaga, Andrina, I was expecting you, he smiled to himself.
He'd been dying to say that line since he saw them leave Andrina's potion labs.
Ah, yes, the vision thing,
Andrina said as Ed turned to face them.
Thanks for reminding me I need to cover the ceiling with claws if I want to take a bath.
I don't think that's how it works, Ed said. But thanks for the vote of confidence.
The herbalist shrugged.
I'm old enough to be your mother, so I probably have nothing to worry about. The head researcher, on the other hand...
So, what do you guys want to talk with me about?
Ed asked in a hurry. Kaga, who had spent the length of the conversation chuckling to himself, stepped forward. He was holding a small vial in one hand, and he set it on the table in front of Ed. It was filled with a sort of brownish-yellowish liquid.
We've made a small breakthrough in the Health Chicken Project,
the monster hunter explained.
We figured you may want to hear about it.
Ed glanced at the monster hunter, and then at the herbalist.
What's in the vial? He finally asked.
Something about the way Andrina smiled made him dread the answer.
Before I tell ya,
the herbalist said,
let Kaga here explain what he found out about our very own giant murderous chickens from hell, all right?
What's in the vial?
It always interested me, Kaga started. How the hell chickens are pretty much willing to murder everything, including each other, no matter the size or the threat. Pretty much only Levy managed to earn the respect of one of them, and we haven't been able to replicate her results. But,
he said, raising a finger,
they still live in small groups. They don't eat their offspring. Not that often, at least. There must be a way for them to regulate their aggression, right? In fact, there may be several ways. This vial over here is the result of me putting that theory to the test. Do you know what pheromones are? My clan learned about them from a witch doctor who was also an expert in an almost extinct style of martial arts. Pheromones are a creature's way of telling friend from foe, and hell chickens work the same way. This vial is full with pheromones.
Ed grimaced as he uncorked it. It smelled like it looked. Rancid and disgusting.
Ugh, it's urine, isn't it?
He asked, hurrying to cork it again. His butler hurried to grab a couple incense sticks and light them to mask the smell that threatened to fill the room.
Oh, yes it is,
Andrina said, her grin growing a few inches.
It's urine gathered from a female hill chicken a few hours before she laid a fertilized egg. I turned it into a very potent concoction that will last a couple days.
Oh, Ed said. He blinked as he realized what he was hearing.
Wait a second. How the hell did you manage to get... this?
Let's not talk about it,
was all Kaga said about it, with the distant look in his eyes of a man who has seen and done terrible things.
In short, anyone that douses himself with the pheromones won't be attacked by the hell chicken mounts. So far, it's been the only way my monster hunters have made any advancements in the mounts' training.
Ed and the butler exchanged terrified glances.
So we need to cover ourselves in hell chicken urine if we want to be safe from them?
Safe is a strong word, Kaga said slowly. I mean, as long as there are no nearby male mounts who are in heat. Now that I think of it, it's mating season, so you probably don't want to get near the breeding pens if you're doused in pheromones.
The Kuffdar snatched the vial away. Andrina lost it at that, and began to laugh big, booming cackles while she hugged her belly. Ed looked at the vial and shivered. Levy and Folk were huddled in front of the head researcher's work table, which was covered in strange tools, shears, engraving knives, and other instruments, as well as a new dish like the first one the witch had made. Ed saw them long before entering the research laboratory, using his dungeon vision. When he reached them, the both of them turned to greet him. Levy looked like hell, even paler than usual and with deep bags under her eyes.
Ed!
She called.
Come take a look at this. We've made so much progress.
The dish had its outer edge covered in tiny runic engravings, which came together to form an array of interlocking magical circles. It vaguely reminded Ed of circuitry.
It looks finished, he said, touching the glass surface with his finger.
It was cold to the touch, with no visible signal of its purpose or design. It was strange to think that such a fragile creation could tip the balance of power between dungeon lords and heroes if properly utilized.
Only a few details to fine-tune,
Levy said.
We still need to test it, obviously, and figure out a way to modify a scrambler power to work with it. We'll need to abuse objectivity a bit to create the effects we require as well.
She placed a hand on the spellbook on her lap.
Thankfully, I bought all the spells we'll need already.
Ed nodded. He was eager to start learning new spells with Levy, but he'd had so little free time in the last couple of days. Not for the first time. He wondered how days could pass by so quickly. If he weren't sure it wasn't the case, he could have sworn that Ivalian time happened faster than Earth's, where his 9-to-5 work shift at Laser Shark could pass by so slowly that he'd wonder if time hadn't actually frozen.
I guess it's different when you're having fun. And fighting for your life and the lives of everyone you care about.
Lord Wright, thank you for the opportunity of working on this project,
Folk said eagerly.
It's the chance of a lifetime, truly. For me to be a part of something this big, it's a dream come true. I cannot wait until we start massacring the Haligians after crushing their damn heroes for the last time,
he declared, puffing up with pride and battle lust. Ed gave the intern an uncomfortable grin. Sometimes he forgot that the new minions weren't exactly the best of people. It was easy to forget, really. They acted so normal most of the time. Until they didn't.
The only problem I see, the dungeon lord said, is that we'll have to test it the hard way. In combat against a heroic team. We'll need to hurry and create new disposable dungeons for our experiments. But that's no problem.
Give it a month,
Levy told him.
Then the Inquisition won't even know what hit them.
She smiled, almost as fiercely as the Abneteer. That was when the doors to the lab sprang open, and Kaga rushed in. The Kuffdar had a maddened glint in his eye, and his tongue had lolled out from exhaustion. From the look of it, he'd sprinted all the way from the Haganashi camp to here without stopping. At once, Ed knew that something had gone terribly wrong. Chapter 24 Judgment Gallio had a long, sleepless night where his mind took his body hostage and almost drowned it in a sea of vague guilt, where he swore he